Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is my dear friend, Wajahat Ali. You may know Waj from his many cable news appearances. This includes a conversation with CNN host Don Lemon and fellow guest, Never Trumper Rick Wilson, that was so impressive that former President Donald Trump and his adult children retweeted the clip that had been circulated by The Daily Caller. Ivanka Trump even called them real elites, in scare quotes. Or, more recently, you may know Waj in his superhero role as a nerd avenger on The Mary Trump Show. Today, I'll be talking with Waj about his amazing memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, subtitle, and other helpful recommendations on how to become American. If you like what you hear, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and tell your friends. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, Waj, how are you doing? I'm good. I'm really bummed out. I meant to show you my full Lego collection, because in addition to the typewriter, I now have the succulent flowers.
Ah, well done. That's going to help you get a 10 on Room Raider, because they love the succulents.
Do they photograph well? Is that?
The succulents photograph really well. And if you like the succulents, they just came out with two for Valentine's Day, which are really nice. My wife liked it, so I have to make it for my wife.
But I saw that. Didn't you buy some like a Death Star thing? What did you just get?
I bought the Death Star to celebrate the publication of my paperback, and I'm making the Millennium Falcon slowly but surely. It's taken over the dining table, and my wife tolerates it because even she admits that it actually looks very cool.
Oh, I'm so glad you got that plug in. I'm always forgetting because I, of course, purchased the hardcover of Go Back to Where You Came From, but the paperback just came out.
Yeah, you like it. You got to be on your plug game 24/7. It's something that Jews and children of immigrants aren't good at. We have to, because we're always so self-deprecating because of the way we're raised. But then along the way, you have a friend slap you upside the head and said, if you don't promote your own stuff, no one else will. But you're like, I have a book out. It's pretty good. My mom kind of likes it. It'd be nice if you can read it. I hope, maybe. I'm sorry. I apologize for living.
Well, I hope your mom likes it. You cut her a lot of slack, given how critical she is of you and all the wonderful things you've done for her, no?
No, she really likes it. You know, the interesting thing is that there is a joke within our communities that there's a holy trinity of occupations, and that trinity is doctor, engineering, business, and I would add corporate law in the last 25 years, and the fifth is failure. And my I'm failure, apparently, even though I'm a recovering attorney, but I never was a corporate attorney. But my parents, unlike so many other South Asian immigrant parents, were not stereotypical. They actually always encouraged me, which unfortunately makes me very rare compared to a lot of my friends who have nurtured artistic ambitions. They always have and continue to kind of always support me. And they always tell me to keep writing. So I was very lucky. I was very lucky.
Well, I just want to like hold you to the truth because, yes, your parents were great and encouraging. But you mentioned that you were always told you should have a backup plan, something to fall back on. Me too. That's why I got the law degree.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And now you're doing podcasts and speaking. You seem so much happier. And then I'm like, oh, yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, how does Jen have time? Isn't she a law professor? Are you neglecting your law students?
No, I was on campus teaching securities regulation today. We're teaching. Did you take SecReg when you were in law school?
I didn't. It was offered, but I'm like, it sounds too nerdy and smart for me.
Oh, it was so fun because I the first few classes, I just tell them, I'm not going to test you on this. I just want you to understand sort of the background about how you know, synthetic securitizations of residential mortgage-backed securities with naked credit default swaps led to the downfall of the financial system. And none of their eyes glazed over. It's so awesome.
I understood what you just said, too. See?
Oh,
and that would be actually be very interesting. And unfortunately, if more people knew about it, the more we could hold those people accountable and make sure that doesn't happen again. But all of those people, Jen, fail up. So I think the lesson that we can learn is if you and me are aggressively wrong about everything, especially in politics, maybe you and I can make a lot more money.
So speaking of money, I know we're supposed to talk about your book, but like, let's talk about money. I'm thinking maybe you and I should start a consulting firm.
About how not to make money?
No, a political consulting firm. Don't you think we've got good advice to offer?
So our mutual friend, Danielle Moody, who's the co-host of the podcast that we do called Democracy-ish. We were just joking that we can't do it because we've been right. So in DC, I'm in Virginia right now, but in DC, you have to be, like I was saying, consistently and arrogantly wrong about every major event and never apologize. And if you do that, oh dear listener, then you will fail up and make tons of money. However, if you are like Jen and myself and our batting average, I would say is exquisite, especially the past 6-7 years, you get called difficult, reactionary, wild, hysterical. And when you ruffle the feathers of the establishment in DC, New York City, it's kind of like these rules, right? It's like a George Carlin.
Wait. I got to cut you off. You're going to get to your George Carlin thing, but no one calls me difficult.
No, of course not. Not you.
I know you're trying to bring me into the, like, make me feel like I'm part of the community, but I'm always called very agreeable, pleasant.
But you are agreeable and pleasant, but you also on your Twitter, you see me, I'm trying to hold in my laughter. I'm biting my cheek. I'm very curious to see what the Taub family thinks of this self-reflection by Jen. But it's one of those situations, in all seriousness, George Carlin said, it's a big club and you ain't in it. And it's one of those situations where, you know, for those who are on the outside, you have to realize I always describe it as this very incestuous ecosystem, the town, as they call it, where everyone kind of scratches their back. You know, I scratch your back, you scratch my back, and they help each other fail up. So I feel like many of my friends have said, you know, you've been right about a lot of stuff. This is what I get. I don't know if you get this. Waj, you should be making more money than you actually make. You should be more famous than you are. I'm like, I'll take that as a compliment. I've been getting that my entire career. I don't know about you. Why aren't you more famous? I'm like, I don't know. I don't look like Hasan Minhaj. I'm sorry. I'm like fatter Hasan Minhaj.
I think you're lovely. And I think this whole thing about self-image and self-deprecation, I need to like not allow that. But I have to say, I've got a confession for you. As I said often to people, I bought your book when it came out because, of course, you want me to buy your book when it comes out. But I hadn't read it till this week. Are you upset with me?
Shame, shame. No, I'm not, because you were kind enough to still promote it.
Well, I read the blurbs on the back, and I know you're a fantastic writer, so of course I promoted it. But I finally read it, and it's everything I said was good about it before, but now I can actually back it up by having read it. It's amazing. And emotionally, it's the full range. Like, you lead with humor. And then just when I have my guard down because I'm laughing, I'm crying. It's shocked, unbelievable. And I wonder if, I'm thinking about how at the beginning of the book, you talk about how you use humor to make very difficult truths about America accessible. But I also think maybe it's not just a rhetorical strategy, but it's kind of maybe your whole personality, kind of like my analogy is creme brulee, you know, creme brulee, that delicious dessert with where they put some kind of blowtorch on the sugar on top to melt it. It has a sort of hard crust and you've got to like break through it to get to the creamy goodness. I kind of feel like that's how your book is. Like it has a sort of, I mean, humor you think invites people in, but in a way, humor may make hard truths accessible, but they keep you as a person at a distance. So like I have never known all these stories about you. Like I have known you for a year maybe?
I think longer, yeah.
Yeah, only reading this book that I find out how many near-death experiences you have had. I find about the curse or Nusser on your family. I hear about your parents' experience with being in prison, how you held the whole family's business together. I mean, I didn't even know about the scar on your forehead, and now I'm trying to like stare at you to see. I don't.
Look, it's a dent in my head. Look.
I just don't see it.
It's wild.
That's a shadow, no?
No, that it's line? A dent. It's a
that's
dent.
A dent?
That line goes all the way up here. That's my Klingon scar, and that's my Harry Potter scar. And that's literally, everyone thinks it's a shadow, but it's literally a dent in my forehead. And the next time we see each other, I'll have you run your fingers over my forehead right now. And look, it literally, my forehead caves in. People are like, that's amazing. It was really good when I was single and I liked a girl. I'm like, you know, I used to do that. And they're like, oh, wow. It was a good first move.
You know, Sarah's not going to like that you offered for me to do that next time.
But now it's fine. Now it just becomes like a party trick. And Sarah's like, yeah, feel his forehead. Look, he's a freak. Look at him. But, you know, it's one of those situations. You made an astute observation about humor in the sense that, you know, Jews especially and any marginalized community know that humor is necessary for catharsis, which, you know, the Greeks said was a release after tragedy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so many terrible things happen. You can either laugh or cry or sometimes both. And humor is necessary to release the pain, number one. Humor, and especially when you laugh, it releases endorphins, which makes you feel better. And as psychologists have studied that when people are laughing, human beings have this remarkable ability to lower their guards, and they're more susceptible and open to otherwise hostile ideas that they would otherwise not entertain. So it can be used very strategically as a Trojan horse, which I have always tried to do, number one. Number two, it's part of my personality. I think I just like entertaining folks sometimes. I like being funny. I don't like being a clown, but, you know, it's the way you perceive the world. And you can take out bullies and tyrants. I was a fat kid and, you know, shy and sick, but it was never necessarily purely reactive in the sense that I'm going to develop this as a defense mechanism to survive. I actually proactively enjoyed it, but it also becomes a good weapon that you can use. But the third part that you mentioned, where I think is an astute observation that many folks have not, even people who've known me for a long time, haven't really picked upon, and I'm not one for psychoanalysis, is I can be very warm with people, I think, inviting and friendly, and I'm a good friend or acquaintance, but there's a distance there, and so many of my friends who've known me for years said exactly what you said. I had no idea. What the hell? You never told us anything. You were going through all this and you're inviting us to your house and you're like, you know, doing this and doing that. What? And a lament of many of my friends, I think, over many years has been Waj will open up to a point, but then he won't. And so he'll be there for us and we'll like pour our heart out to him, but he'll only give us so much. And I don't know if it's my personality, Jen, but I always joke with my wife. It's like, God forbid, if it's one of those movies where like you take poison and you're about to die, like in a month, I won't tell anybody. I'll never call anyone. And the day I'm about to die, I'll just like drop a book, my last 30 days on life. And my friends are like, what the F? And I'll just die.
So why is that, do you think?
You know, it's. I think it's personality. I'm not one to ever pick up the phone and call people. I think I don't trust that many people as much as they trust me. I have a distance. And there's also this old school, antiquated mindset of the which I do not recommend people, especially the youth, adopt. Right, like that Spartan man who suffers quietly. And then just dies, right? Like I always joke with folks that if you gave most men around my age and older an option, like if the Grim Reaper comes and says, all right, you have an option. You can cry once and I'll give you 10 extra years of life and it'll be 10 really good years. Or don't cry and you die at the age of 65. I think most of us will be like, just kill us now. And the Grim Reaper is like, whoa, calm down. Wait, that's not an option. We're like, just die. We'll just die right now. I think it's this old school male mindset that I have that I do not recommend people have. And thankfully, the youth is much better. They talk about self-care and they cry. And my wife looks at me like a freak. She literally says, "You're a cyborg," because I haven't cried in, like, I don't know, forever. She's never seen me cry. My wife's the opposite. Deeply empathetic, kind, like cries like 3 times a day, cries while watching freaking Grey's Anatomy. I think it's just the type of old school male that thankfully is being retired, that I think is deeply unhealthy, but it's something that I'm working on. That's just my personality.
But I'm just thinking about this as you're talking about crying. I'm like, I don't know the last time that I cried.
Yeah, I think you're somewhat similar like that.
Yeah, I'm just like, but no, seriously, do you think you know the last time you cried?
I've never really openly bawled or wept. Maybe like a solitary tear, and then I get pissed off at myself. But even then, it's been like forever. I don't even remember, honestly. I'm not a weeper. I'm not a bawler. I don't cry. I just keep it in.
I nap if I'm stressed out. I don't like cry. I don't know. I should think about this. Was it a movie? Anyway, this isn't about me. This always happens. But
no, but it's interesting, right? I think we're the creatures of like, take it. You know, I can take, like, and I always pride myself. It's the type of interesting masochism, which both helps us in life, but I think also it hurts, which is something I'm trying to work on, is I can take it. I can take more than most. You know, people fall. What crushes most people, I can take.
I think it's also, well, I think it's some issue maybe around control. I mean, you talked about OCD. You also talk about a little bit about detachment, being, you know, you're maybe detached from all this stuff, and maybe, I mean, well, I just have to say, just to, I mean, you wrote about it, so I guess it's nothing's off limits, but, you know, on page 184, you know, kind of in the center of the book, you're 30, you're kind of having a lot of success with maybe, I don't think that it's the play yet. I think you're, I don't remember what was going on, but your friends think you've made it, but you're also homeless, helping your parents who've lost their house to criminal forfeiture. They're about to serve their sentences for these white collar crime convictions. And you try to, this is a huge contradiction. And you say, you're telling your friends and they're not hearing you. And so you said, eventually I stopped telling anyone and just kept it all hidden. But then here you're telling everyone.
You know, it's a process, right? So it is a huge contradiction, because people have said, holy crap, you were so vulnerable in this book, you let it all out. And yet in person, we had no idea. And so maybe the book is a medium and a means for me to share everything that I otherwise would not share in person, number one. And number two, I think maybe it is a sign of hopefully progress that it took me this long to tell the story, right? I had a book agent come after me for like 9 years, and good things take time. And I think as I was nearing 40, and, you know, my daughter was surviving cancer and we were going through the pandemic, I just felt like now was the time. And I felt like the story that I wanted to tell, the audience would finally be receptive to it, right? Like, I felt like America would be receptive to go back full circle, the warnings that you and I have tried our best to convey through our mediums, right, about what's happening in this country. And it's one of those situations where you mentioned control and protection. I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, not to psychoanalyze both of ourselves, but, you know, our need to be in control, controlling the situation, being a step ahead, not being weak, you know, not faltering, not falling down, making sure we're not, you know, the rug isn't swept under us, right? Vulnerability is seen as weakness. It can be exploited. People can hurt you. And so for me, those few moments while I was going through this situation, I was 30 years old. My father was in jail. My mother was given 6 months to self-report. We had overnight lost everything again. We were homeless again. I was literally staying in a bedroom, sleeping on the same bed with my mother as a 30-year-old man, as my book, my play was about to be published.
Oh, that's right.
I had written, you know, for The Guardian. I was giving speeches. I was a licensed attorney. My friends thought I was the one that was crushing it. And this was my reality. I always joked like it was the Twilight Zone episode. I didn't know if it was like a comedic episode or a horror episode, right? Because I used to tell people, these, you know, you're human. So there used to be these moments where I used to try to be like a normal human and be like, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm homeless. And you would assume people would say, oh, no, or like, tell me more. But instead, they'd be like, ha, 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 oh, Waj. And I'm like, wait, what? And I think there was a disconnect where people didn't believe me. Or I think about this often. You know how someone tells you something like that you have, it's just so overwhelming that you don't know how to respond. So you either laugh nervously or you just shut down and switch the subject. I think that's what also happened. And the third thing I sometimes think about, and I say this in the book, the power of the story, you know, and how powerful a story can be. And I think, well, what we're witnessing right now, where they're trying to ban books and ban textbooks and ban history books, right? There was the story that was conveyed about me and my family as a result of this white-collar crime and conviction that my parents challenged was that we were sitting on $100 million, that my parents were scammers, that they had defrauded Microsoft. And the headline, Jen, becomes the story. And the headline flattens the lived reality of an entire family. And so I think people assumed, oh, that Waj, they're probably just sitting on millions and he's just telling a tall tale to make us feel like, you know, he's a victim. I don't know, Jen. But all I do know is like, nobody believed me. And I felt like I was living in a horror story where I'm literally like, I just told you I'm homeless. Like, I don't understand. And people are like, oh, anyway, pass the omelet. And so it became like a long, lonely uphill journey where, you know, I don't wish this on anyone. The contradiction that you mentioned was my life, where here I am a public figure, where I'm able to talk to everyone else, but I'm not able to talk to anybody.
Mm. I want to, you know, the white collar thing because I'm so interested. I'm trying to, in reading through it, it seemed like there were a series of different things that happened that somehow led to them being ultimately indicted in this Microsoft thing, but I didn't understand the Microsoft thing. Maybe you can you kind of start at the beginning with that employee who did whatever? And let me just say this differently. I know this is your story, this book, it's your interview, it's not your parents, but I want to hear from you how you describe what happened and how you've come to terms maybe with not knowing everything.
So I spent like 2-3 more pages in your first draft. And then both my editor and a friend said, you know what? You don't need to just like say enough. It's so complex, but it's, and because I wasn't really trying to even defend my parents. I was just trying to, as an author, trying my best to weave this absurd, complex labyrinth out for people. And they're like, dude, it just like makes it even more murky. So long story short, things were going really well for my parents, right? Up and down, Pakistani Muslim immigrants, you know, I would say middle class, then became upper middle class, high highs, low lows, you know, normal stuff. Nothing really too freaky. Never had any brush in with the law, never even got arrested.
And this is in California.
California, 1995. Okay. 1995, my parents are actually doing really well.
Wait, you're being really murky because you're just talking about abstractly. What was their business they were in?
Yeah, so I'm about to tell you. 1995, things were going really well. My parents had this computer business where they used to do bids for big contracts with universities and the government. And they used to win these bids, and the government used to say, like, we need 40 computers. We need, you know, like, computers with these specifications. So my father got into that early with my mom and actually ended up doing really well, winning these bids. One of their employees
Stop. Before you get to the trouble.
Yeah.
So they were like a government contractor.
There was a government contractor, right? A lot of people used to respond to these bids. And my parents, you know, would like win the bid. And they had a relationship with both universities and governments, like these big orders to fulfill.
Where would they get the computers and software from? They'd buy them from the
Yeah, company. You buy them and then make them. And then they used to make them. They had like people. I remember in the office where they used to like literally make the computers there and like put mm-hmm. in the software and the specifications, right?
Oh, so it makes sense. So my kid made a computer the other day. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah, so the business was good.
Yeah.
All things were going well. You know, they're expanding. And now it's not just like mom and pop. There's like 30, 40 people working for them. there was this one person who was working with them, an employee, who worked for them for a while, who, you know, submitted a bid. And on the bid, he makes, I wouldn't say like he does a lie or he like says something like a fib, right? So the government, it was for like the Department of Education, I believe. The government catches it, and what they do is they punish my father, who had nothing
to do with it. Do you know what the misstatement or mistake
was? It's in the book. It's in the book, and I'm forgetting right off the top of my head.
Well, I remember the second one. Something had to do with how long they were in business.
That was the second one. Yeah, so the first one. Yeah, the first one was over like a software specification, but there was like a fib.
Okay, got you.
Yeah, because he was being over aggressive just to get the bid, and he lied, right?
So the lie
gets caught. But the punishment here, this one was interesting. This one really spirals it. The punishment was like a draconian punishment that instead of a fine or like a slap on the wrist, they disbar my father from ever like doing this again. So my father's like, wait, what the hell, man? I might like, you know, why are you disbarring me? So it was like
disbar means what?
Disbar means that you can never bid again with the government.
Wow.
For these type of, it was huge. And then, so my mom then takes over the business. My dad does something else. But then, so they start again. They have to start the business again because it's good business. The second time around, another employee who's a good employee lies about how long they've been in business. Because in order to get like the bid, you have to be in business for like 5 years. I think they were only business for 2 years. This time around, they come back and they say, it was actually your father using your mother as a patsy and a Trojan horse. And like it's now like a fraudulent case, right? And so they disbar both my father and my mother. My father has to like appeal the case. The case goes to the Ninth Circuit, and my parents win the case in the Ninth Circuit, right?
Okay, wait, so stop. Because this is not in the book, and you may not know. Who? Was it a competitor? Who ratted your parents out for the small thing?
No, not a rat out.
Big deal if they were 2 years in the business or 3 years. That doesn't seem material.
It doesn't matter, but it was enough of a fraudulent bid on a government contact.
Got you. That
I got. So this is where my.
Oh wait, now, so the Ninth Circuit they win. Ninth Circuit.
But this is very important, right? Because this is very important. As this is happening, right? For my parents, they're like, "What the hell?" It's one thing after another thing, right? So now they feel like, okay, things are going well. We finally got out of it, right? They get into a business, and with this business, and this is what leads to the trial by fire.
Oh, wait. So just make it clear. When you say now it's going well, like the Ninth Circuit sides with them, they're like, phew, we're good. Let's keep doing our business.
Up and down, lost everything, but at least we're not, like, no one's in jail, whatever, okay? They have this business where they get a license from Microsoft to sell educational software, right? They get the license. They sell the educational software. My mom and dad said it was a good business.
Wait. Who do you sell it to?
Anyone. So back in the day, even though it was educational software, on the kind of unspoken rules or the kind of the custom and the conduct was that you would get the license. You would purchase the software, not from Microsoft. This is very important. This is where I think you, Jen, as a lawyer, it's a very interesting case. So you get the license from Microsoft, but there was a seller called Ingram Micro. And they would pay the money. The Ingram Micro would sell them the software for, I don't know, let's say like $5. And then it would be up to my parents and anyone else in this industry to sell it to whomever for like $10, $15, $20, right? Everyone in that time was kind of selling it. So you didn't necessarily have to be an educator to get the software. That was kind of like the norm in the industry, right? So my parents do this for, I think, like a couple of years. They do really well. Microsoft knows what they're doing. Ingram Micro knows what they're doing. Everyone knows my mom is the one there. Like, it's good business. They finish the business.
Who are you selling it? Wholesale to schools or are you selling it to individual retail?
I don't know. I think they were selling both, but they pretty much sold like a whole bunch, right?
Okay.
They took the money. They leave the business and they start a website. This was back in the day, like 22, 23 years ago. And the website that they started was to sell nutritional supplements and vitamins online. They do it all themselves. My father sends, money in Pakistan to do the, tech support because, they're from Pakistan. The nerve center is in Fremont. And, they actually pull it off. And so a month before.
What kind of supplements? Like what kind of
vitamins, herbs, like organic stuff. Like they were early on the organic stuff. They were
like a good time.
Yeah, they realized like this is going to be the future, right? And so the Extract was a really good website. So I knew for a fact, now I'm 20, 21 years old. I know my father's on the phone all the time in Pakistan. I know there's workers in Pakistan. I come to the office. I see them like shipping stuff out. Like that's I know this is legit, right? A month before, they're about to make profit, which is huge because they didn't borrow money. Like this is their own money. They're like, we're going to make profit next month, right? A month before they're about to make profit, right? It's April. I'm about to graduate. It's 2002. I'm 21 years old. I'm a senior at UC Berkeley. They've gone through like these just like 6-7 years of just legal cases and chaos and up and down. So much pressure, so much stress, right? My parents get arrested. Like nearly a dozen armed FBI agents come. They drag them out of bed. My parents are wearing their Costco pajama suits. My grandmothers, in their broken English, are terrified. They don't know what's happening. And I get a call that night. I get a call from my aunt. And my aunt says, listen, I don't know what's happening, but your parents are arrested.
Remember, you're at a restaurant, though. You got to describe
it. I was at Shalimar Restaurant on Geary and Jones in San Francisco, which was like 30 minutes away from UC Berkeley. And we used to go there once in a while, us wild and crazy Muslim guys having like $6 chicken borti in the tenderloin. And to quote Dave Chappelle, ain't nothing tender in the tenderloin, right? And so I get this call from my aunt. She calls like 2 or 3 times. So I'm like, it got to be something. I step out, pick up the call, as I'm licking the chicken tandoori. And she says, yeah, you're the only child. Your parents have arrested. I have no idea what's happening. You should come home because you got two grandmothers. And I'm like, what the hell? And so my parents get arrested, as I mentioned in the book, in something called Operation Cyberstorm. At the time, Jen, that was the biggest anti-piracy crackdown in America. Robert Mueller was far more useful at that time as the head of the FBI than he was during the Russia investigation. He comes all the way to Santa Clara, huge press conference. My parents, along with 24 people of Operation Cyberstorm, are on the front page of the FBI. Now, my parents, in the 31-count indictment, have nothing to do with piracy. So the question you should be asking is, like, if they have nothing to do with piracy, why were they caught up in Operation Cyberstorm? Very good question, oh dear listener.
Wait, before I ask that question, they're not the only defendant in this indictment, is that
correct?
There are
about two dozen folks.
So their name just shows up among these other people.
There you go.
Okay, got it.
And my parents' terrible luck is in their Fremont business complex across the street. The alleged mastermind of this piracy ring is actually, like, I think her name was like Sheila Wu. And I remember my mom said to me one time, she goes, hey, she looked across from the garage of the office complex. She goes, I think those people over there are doing something shady, right? So there's like most of the people were part of that alleged conspiracy to do Microsoft piracy. My parents had nothing to do with piracy. So the question should be like, why'd they get caught up?
Why did they get caught up?
My parents got caught up because the government, along with Microsoft, alleged that they fraudulently obtained the license from Microsoft to sell educational software. And this is the power of the story. If you read the story of the indictment, you will be convinced that my parents are these criminal masterminds who from like the year 1999 concocted this master plan to, fraudulently obtain this Microsoft license and then fraudulently sell. And then they said that literally everything that my parents got with that money was part and parcel of this fraudulent scheme. So they got property. And my father, since I'm the only child, said, listen, I don't know what's going to happen to us. I want to get property in your name. The property was now under subject of criminal forfeiture, right? The money that got sent to Pakistan that had concocted a theory and conspiracy, money laundering, wire fraud, like literally everything that went downstream and touched the money was now like taken up as part of this fraudulent scheme. So the narrative from the government was the following. These mother effers have escaped justice for the past 6 years. These mother effers, especially the father, is this criminal mastermind who is using the mom as a patsy. And aha, we got them finally, right? And so because my parents had this, previous history in the local paper, Jen, you know how it is. Newspaper writers, you know, they're just Googling. They're doing LexisNexis search. They're like, oh, the Alis. They're mentioned among the two dozen. So who gets the headline news? It's right. My
parents.
Bucklefold. Not Sheila Wu or other one else. It was my parents.
Right.
You know, Fremont scammers defraud Microsoft for $100 million. So where does $100 million come from?
Yeah,
because
where?
Microsoft, in its damages, alleges $100 million. And you're a law professor, but people who don't know, in indictment, you can allege anything, right? Like Johnny Depp can sue Amber Heard for millions of dollars. Doesn't mean she's going to get it or vice versa.
You say, I mean, Microsoft is the so-called victim in this case.
There you go.
So it was the government getting the information from the victim saying, we're out $100 million, and now everyone thinks your family has it, which is why, Waj, you should be the one starting the news network.
Exactly. So that's the funny thing. So the headline becomes the story, the power of the story, the power of the single story. And overnight, the headline became my parents, scammers, sitting on $100 million. Maybe the son was involved. Maybe he wasn't. Front page of the FBI. LA Times is coming around. Local news is coming around. And what happens, Jen, when a story like that comes out in a local community? Bad news travels fast. And so overnight, we lost the friends, we lost the community, we lost the credit, we lost the money, we lost the homes. Both my parents are in jail, and they were in jail for a year because
of— Okay, let me just stop there.
I hope that was helpful and clear. Was that clear?
Yes, it was incredibly clear. And there's so many things that are concerning. One, I mean, being abandoned by the community, and, you know, they're part of the community. I wonder about the friends at the mosque. But the most upsetting thing to me is because of bail that was set so high, they couldn't get out. If they were anybody else, why did they set the bail at $1 million or whatever? What was it set at?
Yeah, it was like $1 million. And let me tell you, this is so this is literally like six months after 9/11. And even though this is not a 9/11 case, how racism and stereotyping, yes, and Islamophobia shapes narratives, even in the criminal justice system. I remember in a pre-trial meeting when, you know, it was all about, like, you were deciding the bail, the government attorney one time said, we found documents in their home in languages in Arabic and Urdu, and they're Pakistani, and they send money to Pakistan. And then he straight up, I swear to God, said, you know, the Taliban are also in Pakistan. And this is where I have to give credit to the judge. I remember the judge's name, Judge Brazil. He stopped them. He said, that's enough. That's enough. So just to give you an example of the mindset that was, you know, people always talk about, oh, you always whine and complain about racism and the justice system. This is how people prey upon existing stereotypes. And so they were seen as a flight threat, because throughout their entire ordeal with the criminal justice system, right, they went to Pakistan and came back. All their roots were here. So they had a really good case. But because this was such a huge case, they set the bail at like $1 million. And what really, like, it was F my life, this is why I called it the Ali curse, is that I actually had property that I could have used as collateral. But guess what, Jen?
A criminal forfeiture.
The alleged money that we—
Civil forfeiture.
Yeah. And then I asked, you know, the funny thing is when my parents called, and this was my life, right? I used to get a call from my dad. Will you have a collect call from prison? Do you accept? Yes. My father speaks. You can imagine he's freaking out, telling me what to do. After my dad calls, you have a collect call from prison. It's my mom. You have a call from Pakistan. It's the family in Pakistan freaking out. It's the relatives freaking out. I got a business to run, right? I got vendors calling me. I got to go find an attorney. I have to go pay the attorney. All of this was happening.
Wait, stop. But you skipped the most important part. This was your flippin' senior year of college.
Oh, yeah. I also have to graduate.
You have to graduate.
I'm only laughing
because, like, some people have nightmares about not studying for the final. Or, like,
I still have that nightmare, by the way.
But you have layered on top of it, and your parents are in prison.
Oh, you know, the funny thing is,
running a business.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had a month left in school. I had to show up for my finals, and I was so lucky. I'll give her a shout out. Professor Susan Schweik, my English senior seminar teacher, read about what was happening. So this is what happened to her. I finally had to go back to school. I'm like, listen, Professor Schweik, this is what's happening. And she's like, oh my God, I read about it in the paper. That's your parents? And she was like deeply empathetic. And I needed to submit this paper to friggin' graduate. So what she said was this: I'll give you until December and I'll give you an incomplete. because I know you're going through hell. If you can get that paper into me by December, you won't have to, like, you know, leave school. You can actually still graduate. So thank you, Professor Schweik, for that. And I met her actually a couple of months ago randomly at a speech in Chautauqua where she was in the audience, and I gave her a shout out in front of the audience, and we had lunch afterwards. I said, I always wanted to thank you for that. So, you know, incredible. It was wonderful. But the other two finals, I just want people to know, I have no idea how I pulled this off. Went to Berkeley while this was happening, sat for the finals. I got A's on those finals. So I didn't necessarily graduate because I had to do the thesis, but at least I took care of those tests, Jen, that we still have nightmares about to this day. All of this was happening at once. And the analogy I always want to give is the following. This is a comic book analogy. You know, Spider-Man, everyone says, oh, it must be great to be Spider-Man. But anyone who reads comic books knows it's fun to be Spider-Man. It's terrible to be Peter Parker. His life is, like, terrible. It's like this all the time. And there's a group of villains who team up and beat him up. It's called the Sinister Six. So the Hobgoblin, the Lizard, Kraven, Electro, Vulture, someone else. And like every couple of years, it's the Sinister Six versus Spider-Man. And he gets his ass kicked. And then at the end, he barely survives, right? The way it was for me was every day I took on the Sinister Six, I barely survived. I woke up and it was like the Edge of Tomorrow, Groundhog's Day. The Sinister Six would resurrect. So it was like this for a year. And it took me a year to convince people to put their property as collateral to get my parents out. And I got... It was an amazing story how, you know, these people stepped up finally after a year. And after a year, my parents finally came out. And what happens is this, is after they came out, instead of succeeding, I actually completely crumbled. Because once you're in fight flight, Jen, and your body realizes it can rest, what do you think happens? Yes.
Everything falls apart.
Everything fell apart.
Yeah. But this gets us to how you were redeemed. And it all comes back to the writing, I think.
That's right.
So there's one, yeah. So I'm skipping over some of the parent stuff, but at the end of the day, you held it together until you didn't have to anymore. You had already gotten admitted to law school, but you decided to postpone that.
Because my parents got arrested.
Oh, yeah, there's that. And you had to clean up their messes, and there gets to be more of this, right? Because even though they end up appealing their convictions and then end up actually having to serve time. And so then all of this, I think it's after that, right? That they're trying to say to you, okay, we're back. Okay, get your life together.
Right.
Not a lot of, I mean, I love them. They're great in this story, but not a lot of apology or no apology to you, it seems like. And, you know, that would have been nice. But they say to you this fantastic thing, which is, why don't you go back to writing that play? So I think we need to rewind to when you were at Berkeley.
That's right.
So right before, when your parents were kind of caught up in all this stuff, in between that investigation that gets dropped or the Ninth Circuit thing that gets dropped, and when they're later have their home raided and they're arrested, you took a writing class from Call Me Ishmael.
Yeah. So yeah, my parents...
That's not his name, by the way.
Ishmael Reed. My parents, to their credit, insulated me and the rest and my grandmothers from a lot of the stuff. You know, I feel bad because this must have been so stressful, and I caught pieces of it, but they're very resilient people. You know, they have a lot of faith, and they were somehow able to, like, live life while all this was happening. It was, you know, in hindsight, I'm like, wow, that's impressive. Other people could have become bitter, alcoholics, and angry, but they really kind of didn't let it on as much, right? So I didn't know the extent of it until much later. So the same year, the year of 9/11, the year where I'm 21, the year where I'm a senior, I get enrolled in Ishmael Reed's short story writing class. Ishmael Reed is a MacArthur Genius Winner, Pulitzer Prize nominated author, you know, a titan of American literature, wrote Mumbo Jumbo. And after 9/11 happens, he says, meet me after class. And I'm like, man, this guy's going to chew me out because I missed 3 weeks of school because, you know, I'm friggin', you know, part of the Muslim Student Association. And life went crazy after 9/11, Jen. People forget, like, America lost its damn mind, you know.
Oh, no, I remember.
Yeah, you remember, right? So, and I was on the Muslim Student Association as a student leader, and my friggin' email was on the website because my roommate made the website. So guess who's getting all the hate mail and all the media requests? And yeah, I always joke that overnight I had to become the cultural ambassador of like 1.7 billion people without any training. And if I effed up, not only would it look badly upon me, you know how what happens, it looks badly upon your entire tribe.
Well, this is where you borrowed the Yiddishism in your book, which I loved, a shanda. You don't want to be a shanda.
Yeah, you don't want to be a shanda, right? And so your back's against the wall, and you're like a fireman for your community 24/7. And it's exhausting. So Ishmael Reed says, look, our people have been going through it, and he's talking about black folks, for like 400 years. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be bad for your people. But the way we fought back is through art, culture, and storytelling. And, you know, I think dialogue and characters are actually a strength of yours. You should actually write a play. You know, stop wasting your time in my short story writing class. Write me a play. Write me a traditional American play. You ever read Long Day's Journey into Night, Fences, Raising the Sun? I'm like, what? Yes. Write me something like
that. Fantastic, right?
He goes, write me something like that. I'm like, what the hell? He goes, write me 20 pages in 2 months or you'll fail. Okay, bye. So that became the genesis of the play. And, you know, my parents come out.
I love it. The Pakistani Eugene O'Neill.
Right. That's what he said, right? Be like the Pakistani Eugene O'Neill. And I'm like, can I just be Wajahat Ali trying to figure out my major? He goes, no. Write this play. And so you fast forward 2 years now. I'm 23. My parents are out. But, you know, as you mentioned, your parents are like, oh, go live your life. You just can't. You know, I'm stuck at home. I'm not in law school. My credit's shot to hell. I later have to appeal for bankruptcy. I have no money. You know, I'm going through my own health problems. I don't trust anyone. And, you know, for those who have, and I hope you never do, experience criminal justice system, it's like a sword, the sword of Damocles hanging over your neck. Because even though my parents got out, the entire case lasted nearly 9 years.
Oh.
Right? So my parents kind of, you know, in their tough love, but also loving way, were like, why don't you go live your life, Wajahat? Go do what you want to do. And I'm like, how can I live my life when there's this much damage and you might lose your case? And because F my life, I'm actually a good son and not like the character in, you know, Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie. I won't leave my grandmother's. Even if I go say, live my life and you lose your case, what's going to happen? It all goes to hell again and I have to come back. So that was my mindset. Like, you're always stuck, Jen. You're like, you have one foot stuck in quicksand. And you have one foot that can soar. That's how I felt like throughout my entire 20s. So at the age of 23, as I was looking around and there was nothing, the only thing that I had left was this 20 pages of a play. And my mom was like, well, at the very least, finish the play. And I finished the play as a gift to myself for my 23rd birthday. And then Ishmael Reed, my teacher, and sometimes in life, this is what I say, sometimes in life, all you need is one person, a mentor, a friend, a family member, a teacher who believes in you. You just need one person who says, you know what, Jen Taub, you should host a podcast. I think you could do more than just be a law professor. And he's the one who kept after me. He knew what was happening to my parents. He said, just write me 5 more pages. So I finished the play as a present to myself for the 23rd birthday. He came on as the producer of the play. His wife, Carla Blank, who's of Jewish descent, came on as director. It sounds like a terrible joke. A Jew and a Muslim and a black person go try to start a play. And he's the one who first gave me my first money to put on the play.
And the punchline would be, I bet the buffet was delicious.
Yeah, I bet the buffet actually was delicious.
But you did serve food.
The buffet was delicious. The Muslim didn't eat pork. The Jew had to overtip to make sure that people didn't think they were cheap. And the black person... And the black person wasn't the only one eating fried chicken. Everyone ate fried chicken because fried chicken is delicious. But that became the play, and I did it myself. And the play literally helped save my life. And the writing literally helped me get to the point where, despite all the shit, you know, I said, I don't know if I said this in the book, but I said it in speeches, you know, especially when I was 30 and my parents got arrested again and lost their appeal, I told myself, well, I don't see the end yet. The pages are still turning. Let me write my way out and maybe there'll be a plot twist. And I literally wrote my way out, Jen. I wrote my way out of Fremont.
Just
I wrote
like
my way
Alexander
into a marriage.
Alexander Hamilton. I saw that.
No, really, but I wrote my way out. That's it. That's what saved my life.
Mm. And this goes from, somehow we get to like 2009 when you're flying between San Francisco, New York, right? Working with Carla to put this play on. And I have this random question. I've been obsessed about this. So you write in the book that you could fly for $500 round trip from San Francisco to New York on JetBlue for $500 for 8 weeks. What do you mean by that? Do you mean unlimited flights for for $500, or is each flight $500?
Nope. Unlimited flights. Check this out.
What?
Yeah, I know. 2000.
This is the best thing I learned in your entire book.
Yeah, this is the thing that Jen was like when she sent me all her questions. I'm like, this is very random. She goes, I have been obsessed with this. Were you lying or are you exaggerating? Is this literal? Check this out. It's 2009. America was about to elect my Muslim brother president. I'm 28 at this time. And I said, you know what? It's time to bring back the play, because the play got some love in the Bay Area. But all these people are said, America's not ready for an ethnic play. Your play is too ethnic, you know, and that's translation. White people won't like it. So I'm like, I had to wait like 5 years. And then 2009 came around. I'm like, damn it. I'm going to do the play off Broadway in New York, even though I'm poor. But the journey about how we got the play at the New York is in the book. But I just got lucky sometimes. Sometimes you just get lucky. I was like, holy shit, I'm in the Bay Area. I'm a poor writer slash attorney. The play's in New York. It's DIY. I have to be there. How the hell do I afford these friggin' like multiple cross, you know, country trips? It's going to cost like $3,000. And a friend of mine from law school said, watch. JetBlue has this insane special. I can't believe if it's real, but like, just look at this link. For $500, if you spend $500 right now, you for 32 days or 35 days can go cross country multiple times. I'm like, get the F out. He goes, swear to God, bro, call them. So I call JetBlue. I talk to a woman. It's a true story. I'm like, I just read that you guys are offering a $500 package from like August to like late September. And she goes, yes, we are. I'm like, is this real? She goes, I can't believe it, but literally, I cannot believe it, but it actually is real. You might want to jump on it. So I jumped on it. I'm like, this is too good to be true. I might have just wasted $500. And for $500, Jen, I was able to go cross country all throughout rehearsals up until the premiere of my play and like several weeks after my play. Okay. True story.
So the plays, you know, it's getting a second run. It's a huge hit, sold more than you thought, should have been a longer run. This is happening in New York, and you get a bargain on the airfare. You're 29. And shortly after that, the sword of Damocles falls.
That's
your
right.
Parents who you'd gotten out of, the pretrial detention, they had gotten sentenced, but they were appealing it. News comes that they've got to go to prison. Right.
That's right.
That's when I can't even imagine. So this is that moment. And there's something, I mean, the heart and soul of the book is right around there, where you're trying to do everything and you're trying to keep the business afloat. And I think there's a moment when you go take money out of the bank and there was only like $70 left.
No. I thought there'd be $70. It was the Wells Fargo on the corner of Mission and Warm Springs. And I thought that after I took out 20, there would be 70, because I had to be surgical with my Excel sheet in math. And this is why I became an English major. Because after I took out the 20, instead of 70, on the receipt, it said 0.03. And that's what I did. I laughed. I was like, that's literally what I did. So people thought, I remember it was like a beautiful Bay Area day. I describe it in the book. And there were people waiting in line and they see this like brown man looking at a piece of paper laughing. And I'm convinced people thought I lost my mind. That was my response. I chuckled.
But you also had this most psychologically healthy response, which is, I think you got something to eat. I think you came home and you just said, fuck it. I can't do it anymore. And you took a nap or fell asleep. And you describe this in the book as the deepest, most comforting and nourishing rest I have ever known as an adult. I just let it go.
That's right. That's exactly what happened. I took my 20. It became 10 because I took it to Subway. And I had a large tuna sandwich with the works and cookies. And then I went next door to Starbucks. And I had a large venti caramel frap with extra caramel drizzle and whipped cream. I was left with $10.03. I went home to my grandparents and I was like, my grandmothers, my two grandmothers, I'm like, I've done my best. Literally, we have 3 cents left. What can I do with 3 cents? I'm exhausted. It's done. I'm sorry. I tried my best. And literally, like, it wasn't necessarily giving up, but it was like, you know, there's this great saying, and I mentioned in the book, you know, Muslims say, tie your camel first, and then have faith in God, right? So you're supposed to exhaust yourself completely. and then have faith. It's not enough just to have faith. Like, because sometimes people say, oh yeah, inshallah, God willing. Well, what are you doing, right? So I felt like, Jen, I did whatever I could, and the universe decides to slap me in the face with 3 cents. So I kind of laugh and I said, I'm done. Like, what else can I do? And that night, really, I mean, I still remember the seat. It was like the closest I can ever imagine of being a baby in the womb. Like, it was the best sleep I've ever had. And I think there's something to be said about that. When you, it's not about giving up. It's when you know you've done your utmost, you've literally exhausted yourself, and then you leave it to the fates, to God, whatever you believe in. There's something very cathartic about it. It's like you can tap out. You can tap out knowing you've done everything you could. You could go in peace.
And it seems like from there, if you look back, if you look at that one moment, and you know, stuff happens, but shortly after that, you meet Sarah. I mean, look at your beautiful life that's happened, and your parents did come out of prison, and they're wonderful people. You good relationships. Normal stuff happens in those relationships. Didn't you just buy your mom a handbag recently?
I showed you the handbag. I remember I showed you and Mary Trump. I sent you an image in October. I got this invite, last second invite to Singapore, and they paid me an absurd amount of money for this corporate law firm where they're doing their retreat in Singapore, totally normal, in the 5-star hotel that you saw in Crazy Rich Asians, where they have the pool.
Ooh.
Yeah, pool where like the water seems like it's like coming off the side. Totally normal, by the way. And so I was at Marina Bay Sands, and there's this huge 5-star like shopping. And so I had nothing to do for a day. It was like in and out. And I looked at this Louis Vuitton store, and then I remembered my mom used to joke during these days, the days that we were kind of basically homeless. And she said, inshallah, you know, just trying to bolster my spirit. She goes, inshallah, when you make your money as a writer, you can buy your mom a nice purse. And she was kind of joking. She didn't say like, hey, you better buy your mom a nice purse, mother effer. And so I remembered it. And so I bought her this nice purse. And she was like typical mom, immigrant mom. She's like, no, no, I don't need it. I don't need it. And my dad is kind of like, eh, she really likes it. And so she knew exactly the purse, but she goes, don't buy it. Don't buy it. So I kind of surprised her and I bought this purse for her, and I bought a nice watch for myself. I like watches, and I'm like, same thing, the immense guilt. Should I buy a watch? I shouldn't buy a watch. I don't need a watch. And then I looked at it, and I'm like, holy shit, I can actually afford this for the first time in my life. And so then I had to give another speech, I think a month and a half ago. And so I brought the purse with me, and I gave it to her, and she was just really happy. And my dad says, she loves that purse. She wears it everywhere. And so I sent you the purse, and you and Mary were like, good purse. Good choice, yeah, mom.
But you know, when you show me that, now I understand it so much better.
Mm.
Now for somebody who lost so much and who knows, I mean, you have been such a good son. And also for you as somebody who was always looking to, I mean, everyone's always looking to make their parents proud of them. But as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, you know, being a writer isn't on the list. They were supportive of the writing, but never, you know, it was a backup. And to actually have it be a successful career, I think, means a lot to her. So one thing I'm not going to, as we wrap things up, one thing I'm not going to do is let you tell anybody how you got the scar on your forehead, because they're really going to have to read the book to know about that, as well as the several other near-death experiences in the U.S. and in Pakistan. But I want to talk a little bit more about the writing before we go, because so there's this thing. I am astonished how many writers I meet who, if they're writing a memoir or if they're talking about themselves, you don't find out until like somewhere, you know, years into the friendship or hundreds of pages into their book that they fucking had lunch with Toni Morrison and they didn't tell me.
That's right.
You're not the only person who hides out like that. So it'd be the first. I mean, why didn't, with the first time you saw me when we met in LA, why didn't you say, hi, Jen, I wanted to let you know I had lunch with Toni Morrison. And not only that, she gave me a shout out at my play and said it was really meaningful. Why don't you have that like on a T-shirt or a tattoo? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I sometimes forget and then people praise Toni Morrison and I kind of just casually say, oh yeah, I ate dessert with Toni Morrison. And people are like, what? They're like, yeah, Toni Morrison, me and Ishmael Reed hung out for 2 hours before the last showing of my play at the New Eureka. And then she referred to me as a fellow writer, and she was trying to tell Wanda Sykes dick jokes, but she kept interrupting herself because she kept laughing. And then they talked, and I just sat there and listened to her talk about racism and Obama and politics and writing. And then she sat right in front of me for my play. And then at the end of the play, I ran on stage and said, Toni Morrison, what do you think of the play? And then she gave me a very deliberate, very kind blurb that I use now on the back of my play. Oh, that hasn't happened to you? Oh, my bad. I kind of, you know, these so many amazing things have happened, Jen, in my life, both the high highs and the low lows, that sometimes they blur together. And it's one of those situations where I sit there and have to pinch myself. I'm like, oh, yeah, I had French pastry with Toni Morrison and Ishmael Reed. Like, it's a really been a very, I've been very lucky in life.
Okay, I'm so disappointed in you for a couple reasons. One, Toni Morrison, you need to say, like, who, you know, wrote The Bluest Eye and Beloved, but you also have twice mentioned your play without telling me the title.
Oh, yeah, we're learning. This was like when you were trying to promote your podcast without telling anyone, like, what the podcast name was and where it was coming out.
It's called Booked Up with Jen Taub.
Yeah, and then we had me and Mary had to, like literally force you to promote your own book.
Would you come on the podcast sometime?
I was supposed to come on, and then Jen punted me, and then she felt guilty. She goes, oh, you have a paperback coming. That's why you wanted to come on. That makes sense. Let me bring you back. The play is called The Domestic Crusaders. And I want to say this. Let me flex a little bit. The play that was rejected by everyone for not being, for being too ethnic was published by McSweeney's. And then McSweeney's on its own, with the 20th anniversary of 9/11, a year and a half ago, decided to republish the play with an introduction by my friend Hasan Minhaj, who wrote the intro, and Hassan and I have known each other for many years, and Hassan himself was rejected for years for being too ethnic, and look at Hassan now. He gets the last laugh, I get the last word.
I have a copy of that. I bought it from McSweeney's.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. I was going to send you both for free, but I appreciate that you actually bought it.
Okay, now I'm secondly disappointed in you because you did not mention, again, how long have I known you, that Emma fucking Thompson sent you money.
Not only did she send me money, so I don't know if I'm the only one, you know, as a young boy.
I can't be your publicist anymore if you don't tell me.
As a young boy, you know, I have, you know, and as an old male, I have crushes. And, you know, you have the usual crushes. You got J-Lo, you know, perennial, Winona Ryder, Halle Berry. But I always actually had a crush on Emma Thompson, like a huge crush on her in the early 90s. I just thought she was, like, just awesome. And then just following her career, and in her politics, I had this spidey sense, Jen, for whatever absurd, ludicrous reason, Emma Thompson, who's living in England, will really like my play Domestic Crusaders. So being resourceful, I somehow found out who her publicist was. It took me like 6 months, and I engaged in like this back and forth correspondence, and she kind of like took pity on me and gave me like her other like secretary's like email, and I sent her an email, and she said, Emma would like to read your play. Send over the play in hard copy. And so I spent $25 and freaking shipped over this play to England. I'm like, I will never hear from Emma Thompson. Fast forward, like maybe a month before my play is premiering, I get this 2-page handwritten note from Emma Thompson with a check. And Emma Thompson gave me a review blurb, a check for the play, and just really lovely. And she gave me a really lovely note. And then she gave me her email. And then after I got married, like an idiot, I'm like, Emma Thompson, I've written an essay about my marriage and I think you will enjoy it. She read the essay and she said, I love this story. When you're in England, I didn't mention this in the book. When you're in England, I want to cook for you and your wife and I'll have you all over.
And did you go?
No, we didn't get time. And I think the email that she used is no longer being used. So I don't have contact with her. But that's my Emma Thompson story.
Okay, so I really need you to go over to England. You need to call JetBlue and get one of those $500, like, unlimited trips to, you know, to England from D.C.
That totally exists, by the way.
They totally exist. I'm sure they exist. For us, they will. And then you'll have lunch. Oh, by the way, what did you have for dessert when you were with Toni Morrison and Ishmael Reed, you know?
I had... I remember I had a cookie. She had some pastry. And Ishmael Reed, because, you know, he can't, like, he had some, like, sugar-free thing that he shouldn't have had, but had nonetheless.
Ah, okay. And I mentioned this because before we end our conversation, I love your relationship with food, even though it's maybe a love-hate complicated relationship. Do you want to say something about that?
I was a fat kid growing up. I used to wear Husky pants. My grandmother fed me a lot. And even though I was obese as a child, she was still convinced that I was not eating enough. And I remember one day when I was young, I went home and mom had made some traditional South Asian dish. And like most kids, I'm like, I'm not eating that. And my mom's like, well, then you can starve. And my mom literally refused to cook anything else. I came down and I ate it. And so my palate, out of like even my cousins who lived in Pakistan and came here as kids, I can eat everything. Like I'll eat anything. Like, tongue, give me tongue. Goat, I'll eat goat. Brains, give me brains. And my cousin's like, what the F is wrong with you, man? Like I'm like, I don't know, like sour, I'll eat sour, tangy, anything. So my situation is that I love food like most people. I can tolerate and eat most things, but I have, Jen, something that South Asians refer to as tendencies. I can gain weight really quick. I can lose weight really quick. And when you're a fat kid growing up, even when you're an adult and you're no longer fat, and anyone who wore Husky pants will attest, in your mind's eye, you will always be that awkward fat kid wearing Husky pants.
I totally relate to that. And that's for maybe a conversation for an entirely other day. Okay, one last thing before we go. Can we talk about that conversation you had with Don Lemon on CNN? I think Rick Wilson was there. And you, it's one of the funniest things in the world. I think it had to do with some person in the Trump administration trying to intimidate a reporter about Ukraine. And then somehow you guys got into it. Would you remember this in conversation?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I do. It was Mary Louise Kelly was mocked by then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump, and they lied that she apparently didn't know where Ukraine and Eastern Europe, even though she was an expert. It was a 6.5-minute interview. Oof. And we came on, me, Rick, and Don came on to pretty much talk about how attacking journalists and women is the feature, not the bug. And as we were talking, it's actually a good interview. You guys should watch it. About halfway in the interview, Rick says, Donald Trump is mocking Mary Louise Kelly, but he's so dumb, he probably couldn't even place Ukraine on the map. He'd probably just put a U and a picture of a crane next to it. And this, for whatever reason, Don Lemon lost his shit live on television. Like Don Lemon literally put his head down on the desk and started laughing. And then, you know, I used to do improv comedy and I'm live on air. So if someone just, you know, I'm immature. So I'm like, if Don Lemon's laughing and Rick's doing this, so then I start... You know, me and Rick just started going back and forth, and I'm like, all you liberals with your lattes and like avocado toast with your maps and your lines on them maps. Don like loses his shit. Rick loses his shit. So we go back and forth for 2 minutes. Now I'm, having done television, realize I was the first one to be like, okay, I apologize to anyone who's watching. Let's get back to it. I'm not the host, right? But at the time, a CNN employee. And then we finish out the conversation. And I will tell you this. This is how mainstream institutions keep bending the knee, Jen, to bad faith right-wing grievance. That day, everyone laughed. Everyone CNN thought was awesome. They published the clip. The clip goes viral, right? It was only after the right-wing weaponized that clip Donald Trump tweeted it. Then all of our colleagues like, how dare you, Waj and Rick? Shame, shame, shame. But before that, everyone's like, this was a cathartic moment of television. We laughed our asses off. We needed it. And now... lo and behold, I have a lot of fans based on that clip. And many people say, bro, that was the greatest moment in CNN history. Thank you.
It is pretty damn close to it. And what they weaponized it because they had like the Daily Caller sends it around.
That's what happened.
You know that you hit a nerve because Donald Trump and his adult children all retweeted it. I mean, even Ivanka called you real elites in scare quotes. I mean... it's just
and I was part of the ad. I showed up in an ad at CPAC and then RNC. My friends are like, holy shit, man, your face is here. So just goes to show you that they can dish it, but they can't take it.
That's right.
But it's up to the rest of us, the majority, not to bend the knee.
That's right. That's right. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted me to, or you wanted to ask me?
I just sat down and I was like, let's just talk. And I blabbered. That was fantastic. You're really good at this. I enjoyed this. Not sadly. I mean, for you and me, we could probably talk for another hour, but I don't want to bore the listeners. But
No one would ever be bored. So how do we find you? What's the best way to find you?
I'm at Wajahat Ali on Twitter. You can buy the book now, go back to where you came from, pretty much anywhere. Is it Tuesday? You and I join Mary Trump on the Nerd Avengers on her show. You can email me. I'm easy to email and contact. My email is all there. And I usually write columns for the Daily Beast and Medium, and now I'm starting to write. Now they made me a columnist for MSNBC.
Congrats on
that. Yeah. So I got to do two a month for them and two a month for someone else, yada, yada, yada.
Sometimes I think you're also on, did you also say you're on MSNBC a lot?
I used to be.
I feel like I've seen you there before. No?
I think so. I come on, they have me on a lot. So I come on MSNBC a lot, but CNN with the new leadership does not like me.
I mean, I guess they do. Well, it's been so great talking with you. I feel like I see something behind you. Which Lego is that? I need to ask above you. Yeah.
This is Vincent van Gogh's Starry Nights. This is the Great Wave. This is the treehouse.
This is
the lighthouse, and that is Mother Effing Voltron.
I'm starting to get hooked.
Isn't the typewriter amazing?
I didn't do any of it. My kid did it entirely. The same kid who built a computer. I'm not allowed to touch anything.
I had real adults in our home like 2 days ago, and they're like, is that a typewriter? Is that made of Lego? Wow. And these are like professional adult humans. So it's one of those things. Once you do the typewriter, like, and they came around and they saw this, and they're like, my wife was like, wow, your Lego sets actually got us like the most compliments out of anything in our home. So there you go.
So Waj, here's the deal. Will you agree with me that if you go to England, you'll let me know? I'll go with you and I can also have tea with Emma.
Yes, you will be our Jewish cousin Jen, who is accompanying us. I'll say that, Emma, if you want to cook for me, you have to cook for our plus one guest. So there you go.
And I'm kosher, so it's all going to be good.
Great. I can do kosher too.
Okay. Whew. I have so much more to ask Waj about, and I really wanted to have him tell you how he got that scar on his forehead and his other insanely crazy near-death experiences and how he met his wife. But seriously, that's why you should buy the book. It's out in paperback, and I can't recommend enough. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations and How to Become American. Let us know what you think about this book, this podcast, and Waj. I'll definitely pass that on to him. Send me an email at bookedup@politicon.com, or if you prefer to actually use the mail, send me a postcard or letter at bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our favorite authors, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It will really help other people find us. I am calling the Lego Storm in West Farms Mall. Quiet.
Having a great day at Lego West Farms.
Yeah, I'm having a debate with one of my friends whether the plural of Lego is Legos or Lego. I think it's Legos. What do you all think?
It is Lego, no S.
What makes you say that?
That is just historically how Lego refers to themselves. So it is Lego, and then our product is Lego bricks internally. In an official capacity, the plural for Lego is Lego.
What is your name? You're so helpful.
My name is Matthew.
Okay, bye.
How does it feel to be historically on the wrong side of history?
I'm used to it. I'm a Jew.
That's well played.